But today I'm delighted to introduce our speaker, Professor Richard Albert. He's an assistant professor of law here at BC Law School, where he specializes in American and comparative constitutional law, as well as democratic theory and the role of religion in American public life. He's a distinguished academic associate at the Center for Law and Religion at the Cardiff Law School in Wales, UK, and a senior research fellow at the Canadian Council for Democracy. In addition to his numerous publications and scholarly legal journals, Professor Albert frequently writes commentary and analysis for the Huffington Post, Politico, and other popular sites. A graduate of Yale College and Yale Law School, Professor Albert also holds postgraduate law degrees from Oxford and Harvard Universities, and he completed his judicial clerkship under the Chief Justice of the Canadian Supreme Court. So we're delighted to host him today for his talk about the constitutional problem of presidential succession. His title is Presidential Roulette, and I think that should give us some sense of his appreciation of the 25th Amendment. So with that, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm really, really happy to be here. It's really a pleasure for me to accept the invitation, so thank you, Eric. And I'm sorry that Alan Wolf is not here to join us. I understand he's not feeling well, so I send him my best wishes for a quick and sustainable recovery. I want to thank you guys for being here. I know there's a lot of rich counter-programming in our wonderful community of Boston College, and so thank you for taking a minute to come discuss what I think is an interesting and important, timely issue, always timely issue of presidential succession. And I just want to finally recognize my faculty colleagues at the law school for making time to come be with me today. Really appreciate it. I can't imagine myself being anywhere else but Boston College Law School. I really love it. So thank you for your warm welcome so far, 14 months into my tenure at the law school. I'm really thrilled to be your colleagues. So here's my plan for today. I want to discuss with you presidential succession against the backdrop of an imagined crisis. Then I'll walk us through some issues I think we need to think about with respect to how we want presidential succession to work in response to this imagined crisis that I'll describe for you in a second. And then I hope we can have a larger conversation about the stakes involved in this presidential succession law that I will describe to you in a second. My hope is that we'll have a rich conversation, and I think that's where ultimately we'll get the most value out of today's presentation is our conversation together. So that's my plan. So imagine that terror strikes the nation. As the president approaches the dais to deliver his State of the Union address at a joint session of Congress, terrorists unleash the horror of a weapon of mass destruction in the heart of Washington. When first responders arrive onto the scene, they comb through the rubble of bricks and bodies and mortar, hoping to identify the president and the vice president. But neither survived the attack. Who will lead the nation? Well, there's a law that governs succession to the presidency under a circumstance like this. It's the Presidential Succession Act of 1947. And under that law, the Speaker of the House and the Senate President pro tem follow, respectively, when the President and the Vice President are unable to serve. Next in line after that is each of the Cabinet Secretaries according to departmental seniority, which means that State, Treasury, and Defense sit atop the list, and then labor, health and human services, transportation, education fall somewhere in the middle with others. And then homeland security is last. Now, in my view, this line of succession, for a number of reasons, is dead wrong. Indeed, it's my view that the current line of succession is actually no safer than playing a game of presidential roulette. And my task today is to tell you why that is. But I intend to do more than just critique the current line of succession, because I want to propose and defend for you an alternative line of succession, because I think that reconstructing is just as important as deconstructing, and so that's what I intend to do. And my larger purpose, I think, remains achievable whether or not we agree with the alternative that I propose, because my objective here is for us to probe the values that currently shape the presidential succession law, and to invite our collective reflection about whether those values are the right ones for our time. So before I proceed, just recall, remember the line of succession. After the VP, then we have the House Speaker, the Senate President Pro Tem, and then the Cabinet Secretaries according to departmental seniority.
I thought it was always Al Haig.
Yeah. So what's wrong with the current line of succession? Well, I think it values tradition and seniority instead of proven leadership and competence. And those are not the right priorities. What should replace the current line of succession? Well, here's what I suggest. For me, the solution should come into three parts. Three parts. Here's the first part. First, you have to remove the House Speaker and the Senate President Pro Tem from the line of succession altogether. Altogether. Neither the House Speaker nor the Senate President Pro Tem owes her position to presidential-like qualifications. The Speaker achieves her leadership position by virtue of a majority vote of the representatives in the House, while the Senate President Pro Tem is by custom the senator who holds the longest record of continuous service in the majority party. So neither ascends to her position on the strength of presidential traits that could prove vital in a time of crisis. Let me say a bit more about each of the two positions. So the Speaker of the House is typically a master legislator whose expertise in the horse trading and log rolling of Washington politics is what makes her an effective leader as a legislator, but certainly not as a prospective presidential leader. So for me, proficiency in Robert's Rules of Order doesn't translate into preparedness to assume the presidency. Now, for its part, the office of Senate President Pro Tem is also a less than optimal source of leadership in the event of a presidential vacancy. That position has historically been filled by Senate elders, whose advanced age inspires, I think, much less confidence than one might have in a younger successor. So consider, for instance, that the current Senate President Pro Tem, Daniel Inouye, is in his mid-80s. His immediate past predecessors in the post were Robert Byrd, who passed away at age 92 while serving as Senate President Pro Tem, Strom Thurmond, who held the position as a nearly 100-year-old senator, and the late Ted Stevens, who was 83 when he served as Senate President Pro Tem. Now, it's true, experience often comes with age, but there may be a point at which too much of the latter leads to diminishing returns on the former. Those are just two concerns I have with the line of succession. There's an equally troubling concern that occurs to me. It's that someone from an opposing political party could fill a presidential vacancy. A Republican Senate President Pro Tem or a Republican House Speaker could fill a vacancy created by the death or incapacity of a Democratic president, or vice versa. Let me just illustrate the problem for you a bit more concretely, if you will. There'd be a very jarring shift, sudden change in presidential leadership, for example, in 2007, from then President George W. Bush, a Republican, to then Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat. Imagine the shift that that would entail. Other similar examples of a party split between president and House Speaker, they abound in American, in contemporary American politics. From 95 to 2001, then President Clinton, a Democrat, he would have ceded the reins to then Speakers Newt Gingrich or Dennis Hastert, both Republicans. 89 to 93, then President George H.W. Bush, Republican, would have been replaced by then Speakers Jim Wright or Tom Foley, both Democrats. 81 to 89, then Speakers Wright or Tip O'Neill, whom we know here at BC, also both Democrats, would have filled a vacancy for then-President Ronald Reagan, a Republican. These examples are more than just anecdotal. It's a larger trend that has dominated contemporary American politics, actually since the Second World War. There's a growing norm of divided government. Proof positive is the most recent election last week. So if something happens to the president or Vice President Biden after the new Congress is sworn in January 3rd, 2011, the president, acting president, will be John Boehner, Republican. here are a couple of statistics that just show you how frequent divided government has been in American history. From 46 to 92, divided government existed 67% of the time. From 81 to 2001, existed for 90%. So the possibility of a party reversal is actually very, very high. There's a larger question here at stake, too, on the same point, which is that a midstream substitution of presidential party representation vetoes the freely expressed will of the electorate because it imposes upon citizens a choice to which they have not consented. And it's not just any kind of a choice. It's the most important kind of choice about what political values will govern the land. I said my solution comes in three parts. That was the first. Remove the Speaker and the Senate President pro tem. The second part of the solution is to rearrange the order in which cabinet secretaries succeed to the presidency. The order should turn on departmental competence, not departmental seniority. So currently, cabinet secretaries are ranked according to the seniority of the respective departments, which means the date upon which Congress passed a statute creating the department. It's actually a design flaw that privileges tradition over reason. There's no good reason to defer to institutional seniority at the expense of leadership experience, in my view. Now, it's true, maybe there's good reason for placing the Secretary of State atop the list of cabinet successors. Historically, they've been viewed, and indeed have been, international heavyweights and competent administrators. You can probably say the same for secretaries of the Treasury and secretaries of Defense. But the further down the list you go, I'm not sure we can claim to have the same confidence in the ability of the secretaries lower down the list than the state, Treasury, or Defense secretaries. Even more disconcerting than that, I think, is that the Secretary of Homeland Security is the very last successor to the presidency, behind many office holders whose preparedness certainly doesn't rise to the same level that she can boast. So think, for instance, of the Secretaries of Labor, Transportation, Agriculture, Commerce, just to name a few. They all come above the Secretary of Homeland Security. So that's the second part of my solution. You want to revise the order of cabinet succession to the presidency. Now, the final part of the solution is probably the most controversial, but I think it's the most important and the most useful. It is to insert into the line of succession, after the VP but ahead of the cabinet secretaries, former living presidents in reverse chronological order of service, beginning with former presidents of the same party as the unavailable president. Okay, let me repeat that. You want to insert into the line of succession, behind the VP but ahead of all cabinet secretaries, former living presidents in reverse chronological order of service, beginning with former presidents who come from the same party as the unavailable president. So why a former president? Well, former presidents are the only ones equipped with a proven competence, the domestic stature, and the foreign reputation needed to pull the U.S. out of this imagined crisis that I described to you. Now, I want to make a few important, I think, indispensable qualifications to this proposal that I have, to this presidential element. The first qualification is that succession of a former president to the presidency should be only temporary. The former president should fill the vacancy only until a special election is held for the office as soon as practicable, probably within about a year. Congressional studies have been done on how long it would take to hold an election in the event of a crisis like this. They said about 6 months. I'm going to be more conservative. I'll say a year. We'll give them a year to do this. But why only temporary service for a former president? Well, the age of former presidents could be a concern. Americans may prefer an emergency successor who combines similar parts, experience and wisdom, with youthfulness and vigor, over someone whose age might suggest more of the former pair and less of the latter. This leads me to the second qualification for this third element of my proposal. Former presidents have to affirmatively accept the task of succeeding to the presidency as a temporary successor. So you can consider this qualification an opt-in requirement. Not all former presidents may want to bear the weighty responsibility of stepping in at a time like this. Moreover, some presidents may be physically, mentally, emotionally unable to serve after their years of service. And so this is the flip side of the second qualification. A former president may actually be opted out by others of the line of succession, much like the 25th Amendment currently allows a president to be deemed unfit to serve. Third qualification. The new line of succession that I'm proposing to you should exclude former presidents who have been impeached and convicted, and also it should exclude former presidents who've resigned while in office. Now, there's good reason to exclude former presidents who fit this bill, because they may very well be discredited in the eyes of the very people whom they'd be called to inspire with confidence in a time of crisis.
So Clinton would still qualify.
Yes.
Because he wasn't.
Precisely. However, neither single-term presidents nor presidents who've left office with low approval ratings should be excluded from the line of succession. The reason why is that former presidents, they quickly rehabilitate themselves in the eyes of Americans. That's if any rehabilitation is needed to begin with. So consider, for example, the most recent former president, George W. Bush, whose approval rating was very, very low, perhaps historically low, among former presidents when he left office. But since then, his standing has gained 15 to 18 points. Similar trends exist for other living predecessors, Jimmy Carter, George H.W. Bush, and Bill Clinton, although Clinton has always been around 69 to 70% approval ratings. So there's something that happens to former presidents when they leave office. They evolve, usually, into, at least they become seen as non-partisans, and they're viewed as non-political statespersons. Now, although it's true that they, of course, remain associated in perception and often in fact with a political party, their post-presidential work tends to be detached from the partisan operations upon which they once relied when they were elected officers. A few more points. Actually, two more points. Former presidents, they're known quantities, seen as motivated by the public interest and not driven by political posture. They've deliberated on these weighty matters of state in the White House. They've presided over national security briefings in the ultra-secure Situation Room. And they've observed our dangerous world from the unique perspective of the presidency. No one else can say that. No one else can say that. And so, just to recap what the suggestions are, I want to suggest revising the line of succession to insert a former living president into the line of succession behind the VP, ahead of the cabinet secretaries. You want to concurrently remove the House Speaker and the Senate President pro tem from the line of succession. And under this new regime that I'm suggesting, former presidents would serve only temporarily until a special election were held to elect a new head of state, and of course would exclude certain people, certain former presidents, and I've explained what those conditions are. So neither the House Speaker nor the Senate President pro tem, nor a cabinet secretary, I think, has the proven leadership that we see in a former president. Until an emergency envelops this nation and unpredictably catapults someone into the presidency, no one can know for certain whether that successor will prove up to the task of leading the nation in this state of emergency. It's true that the successor designated by the current line of succession could very well exhibit great leadership as an accidental president. That's true. But I think the odds are actually just as strong, if not higher, that that successor would fall far short. And that's precisely the problem. That's precisely the problem. The current line of succession compels America to play a precarious game of presidential roulette that is not worth playing at any time, let alone at the height of a crisis. Thanks for your attention. Look forward to our conversation.